beyond the borders of nationality. It is difficult for us to look at the tragic arc of American history and not view the tantalizing promise of Bacon's Rebellion of 1676 with longing. This distinctly multicultural rebellion, which shook the very foundations of the English colony of Jamestown, which was black and white, bond and free, united against the rule of the burghers, and presented the colonies with a new and profoundly more democratic model. But as we all know, it was not to be. The road most traveled was that of white nationalism and the erection of a Herrenvolk democracy, which quite effectively precluded the construction of a true multicultural democracy and consigned millions of Africans to lifelong bondage, and to those very few who were free to a half-life, nay, a quarter-life of fear, tyranny, peonage, and humiliations for centuries. We yet live in a nation that is shadowed by the vestiges of Herrenvolk white democracy. While we live without de jure supremacist laws, the social, economic, and political effects of that past haunts us and are reflected today in the prison industrial complex, a barren public school system, and grim ghettos across America where joblessness, hopelessness, and want combine to turn dreams into ashes. It is not too much to say that, for all intents and purposes, we live in separate nations, the same land, the same language, but profoundly different historical and contemporary experiences and relationships with the state. For its part, many in black America see so-called white Americans with a profound sense of distrust and betrayal, the very bane of united action. I say so-called because while millions of Americans claim whiteness as a form of social capital, in truth, as the great Du Bois explained, many American whites are in fact octoroons and have some, albeit hidden, African ancestry. We may all recall the news reports of the Westerman family of New England, who were traced to the union of Thomas Jefferson and his black concubine, Sally Hemings. This family had no inkling of either its black or its Jeffersonian origins. It is a telling reflection of the depths of white supremacy in American minds that many of the friends and neighbors of this family shunned them after news of their black ancestry emerged. The very people who played with them, who studied with them, who worked with them, and who prayed with them began to shun them because of their distant black ancestor. If there is any question of the remaining power of American negrophobia, this case study answers that question. Where a phenotypically white family gets dissed because of its black heritage rather than acclaimed for its blood ties to America's third president. But back to betrayal. The history of African and Euro-American unity is one of betrayal. That's largely because, as David Redeker suggests, the wages of whiteness were more rewarding than life among the Untermenschen. To put it simply, it pays to be white. Du Bois has written quite cogently of the public and psychological wage that white workers were paid for their allegiance to white nationality. Conversely, there ain't no money in black-white unity. The proverbial John Brown, you will recall, was charged and convicted of treason and earned, with his fellow black and white revolutionaries, a hangman's noose for the siege at Harper's Ferry. One wonders, treason to what? Whiteness? In our own age, the white anti-imperialists who supported the black liberation movement in the 1970s and 80s, while not hung, were banished to draconian prison terms. But they are but brilliant exceptions that prove the rule. In struggles against rulers, whites have almost always had, since Bacon's Rebellion, a ready-made escape clause, a trap door, a key to the handcuffs, a way out, whiteness. Which way out? Our co-presenter, Staunton Lind, who has a scholar's grasp of American history, presents two distinctive examples of biracial unity against great odds. It is fitting that they occur in prison and in the army. The historical inference is striking, for those two sites are places known for their sheer absence of freedom. We learn, I believe, that situations which provide no escape are those best suited to our objective. Situations with no escape clause, no door, no key, no way out. Further, we need, I think, a project, a clear unity of purpose, something that focuses our communal and psychological energies and that unites our interests. I speak not of grand long-term goals, like, for example, electing a socialist president or social transformation. Those goals, while noble and humanistic, are not achievable in short order. As I said, they're grand goals. The projects must be reachable ones, perhaps local struggles, things that are obtainable. Those little things grow the movement and teach folks that local goals are attainable and that such struggles can be won. The only primary proviso to these projects is that they must be anti-racist. If done on a larger scale, say internationally, they must be anti-imperialist. The great revolutionary historian C.L.R. James has taught that two people who are committed to an objective can form an organization. Their job is to draw others in, to share their vision and their work. That's building organization. That's the root of social change. As Staunton Lynn notes, C.L.R. James has also argued that oppressed groups should organize separately. He explains that blacks who are part of predominantly white groups will always be outvoted, and their interests will be rarely, if ever, truly reflected in the aims, objectives, and struggles of that group. That doesn't mean that groups can't work together on joint projects. They can. It doesn't mean that some of these groups won't be integrated. They will be, but they will be rare and relatively small. When we learn that our interests are more similar than our differences, we will act on what we learn. It all comes down to the convergence of interests. All of us, as students of history, generally agree that American history is rife with racial tragedy, lost opportunities, betrayal, and loss. Yet, much of history is, as Edmund H. Carr taught us, what historians have chosen to write about. If we look hard enough, we find in our history examples to inspire us that open our eyes to the possibilities of the present. The obvious historical example is, of course, the abolitionist movement. It was black and white, slave and free, rural and urban. It was religious and political. It was also blatantly illegal, and in many ways, in many places, underground. It was a bright beacon of freedom in a dark and dangerous night. Perhaps tens of thousands of African-American families owe their very existence to abolitionists who broke the law to provide a hiding place, a meal, a warm blanket, a kind face to an escaped captive, their ancestor. Today, in ahistorical America, youngsters especially have no inkling of the role of the abolitionists in bringing a radical vision of a freer nation into being. Because that brilliant history is lost to many of them, they cannot begin to imagine a new, more human tomorrow. David Gilbert, one of those white anti-imperialist political prisoners I mentioned, has written movingly about many of the people in the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, who, for a brief moment, sought to embody the spirit of their abolitionist ancestors. He writes frankly of the group's shortcomings, including its serious problems with white supremacist attitudes and the ranks. In his new book, No Surrender, Writings from an Anti-Imperialist Political Prisoner, Gilbert writes about the powerful impact of hearing Malcolm X speak 3 days before his assassination. He also notes the power of black culture on white youth, which opened up the heads of an entire generation to the humanity of an oppressed people. He wrote, "First and foremost, it was the impact of black culture, with its more human values of social consciousness, emotional expressiveness, and sense of community, primarily through the genesis of rock and roll. The cultural rebellion also importantly involved an opening of sexual expression that challenged the prevailing straitjacket of repression." Again, we cannot look at today's cultural creations without noticing a marked deterioration in the social, communal consciousness of the artists and their artistic output. While the black music of another generation inspired youth to join the movement, today's predominant style of black music, rap, pushes materialism, capitalist accumulation, individualism, and misogyny. It is unlikely to inspire social action, despite the somewhat surprising fact that the vast majority of purchases of rap CDs are white youth. Indeed, One finds in the imagery, the exaggerated roles and performances, an eerie similarity to the turn-of-the-last-century craze of minstrelsy. Minstrelsy was based on white ridicule and caricature of blacks, using burnt cork to present demeaning portrayals in blackface. While successful white rappers are few today, black artists, in an irony as stunning as it is tragic, provide imagery full of caricature. They portray pimps, gangsters, and various other illegitimate capitalists, to quote Huey P. Newton. Some videos are fully or partially animated. Minstrelsy, it seems, has a new face, one forged by the cruel dictates of economy as much as culture. If we're serious about building social movements, we must use the power of culture, of music, of dance, of art, to promote our vision, to support the movement. We're the movies about Bacon's Rebellion. We're the songs about the brave committed souls who were abolitionists. Where are the plays that mark our view of history, of tomorrow? Ultimately, our objective isn't to study the past. As Marx, speaking of philosophers in the 11th Feuerbach, noted, the point is to change it. The same could be said of historians. Our job is not just to record as if we were silent, shaven monks interred in dark cells, reproducing the lines and sentences of our predecessors. We are ultimately people who care, not only about yesterday, but of tomorrow as well. We can hopefully inspire people to forge a new history for a day that has not yet dawned. Thank you for listening. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.